I'll wager that most of us associate the season of Advent with Christmas time, getting ready for the big season of Christmas at the end of December, because the one comes before the other. But in fact, Advent really has nothing to do with Christmas. When we celebrate Christmas, we are remembering something that God did once upon a time long, long ago. But when we celebrate Advent, we are focusing on what God is going to do in the future, or as Christians expect, the second coming, which, as Mark told his audience, was to happen before his generation passed away. Now, Advent literature is also called apocalyptic literature, which means unveiling or revealing the truth of something that is hidden, which sees time as something that runs forward, chronos, as we talked about a couple weeks ago, but also in cycles called kairos, sacred time that has no beginning or end. The combination of chronos and kairos is what Advent is about, something moving toward a final divine judgment, so to speak, but also something that every single generation on the face of the earth will experience. Advent texts talk about the strange things that will occur, things like the sun and the moon being darkened and failing to give off light. It talks about the stars falling from the heavens and the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. It talks about angels being sent to gather God's elect from the four corners of the world, from the ends of the earth. But this type of literature isn't just meant to speak to us about judgment. It's also literature that's meant to offer us hope to those who are faithful and wondering where the heck God is and all the chaos that surrounds our lives, all the chaos that every generation goes through. It seems that what we experience has been experienced before. Many generations have come and gone who have experienced great tribulation and also great hope. It does this the same way that Job, or the 23rd Psalm, offers hope, for example, by offering us someone we can identify with who knows what it's like to suffer the way we are suffering. And by doing this, it offers us hope because we see that they came through it. Though I pass through the valley of the shadow of death, not that I stay in the valley of the shadow of death. Or as the Bible so beautifully puts it, it came to pass. It doesn't say that the hard times and chaos came to stay. No, those times are just transitory. Now, there's a command that comes with this, however. We are to be patient and to watch for it, because no one knows when this will exactly happen. No one knows exactly when we will move into the chaos. No one except the Father, Jesus says. And there's something else that Jesus tells us. Learn the lessons of nature, he says. Look at the fig tree, and as soon as its branches become tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that spring and summer are near. So also, when you see these things taking place around you, you know that God is near, at the very gates, at the very doorstep of where you live. Now, what are we to make of all of this imagery? And if we were to read these texts literally, we, along with Mark's listeners, would have to say it hasn't happened yet. We haven't seen the sun completely fall out of the sky and the stars fall away and the lights cease. But that may be due to the fact that they don't have to be interpreted literally. Apocalyptic literature is meant to speak to a greater truth than just some literal future event that we have not experienced. What's not unusual at all is the imagery and the language is confusing to us because it speaks metaphorically in a sense. It speaks truthfully, but it speaks in ways that, if we take literally, don't quite add up. And we end up looking then for the wrong things. We stop watching for the correct things. And that's why it's important to understand what this literature is about. 2,000 years ago, every Jew in Israel was looking for a Messiah. But they were looking for a Messiah to be like King David or Moses. They were not looking like for a Messiah that would be born in a barn in a stable as a small infant child. They were looking for a leader, a Messiah who would be mighty, a military leader, a great priest, a great leader that would do unto Rome and others as had been done unto them. But that's not how God decided to come the first time, is it? When we look at how God comes the first time, He comes very vulnerably, born to a very impoverished family that can't even afford a room at an inn, who have to deliver birth in a stable with other animals around it. That's how the Messiah came the first time. So why would the second coming be any different in a certain sense? Unexpected, yet clear to those who were watching for it. There were shepherds, there were wise men, there were poor, and there were rich who understood what this meant when Jesus was born. So too for us today, we can look and see where the Messiah is coming about into our lives. And expecting it to happen, but going unnoticed by all those who have been focused on all those external big signs out there in life, such as the end of the world and all of the other fear-mongering that goes on. So I'd like to tell you a story, because stories are what the Bible really are about. They're powerful because they resonate with us. We can kind of hold on to a story. And this was a friend of mine, Fred, who told me this story a few years back. Well, actually quite more than a few years now, about 10. And hopefully it will make the text seem a little clearer and make some sense. My friend Fred lost both of his parents to old age a few years ago. His dad died on October 29th, 2001, and the next day his mother died, October 30th. And Fred suddenly found himself the executor of an estate, which meant he was responsible for making sure that everything got divided up equally among his two sisters and their families. Now, this is a stressful time for anybody and any family when they lose their family, their parents, and they have to go along and figure out who gets what. Even when everybody gets along, it's stressful and trusts each other's motives. But imagine how stressful it can be in a situation where every decision that you make is assumed by your sisters to be made to get them. And every decision that he made was based upon the assumption that they were greedy and looking for nothing more than monetary gain. In short, there wasn't a lot of trust between the three siblings, Fred and his two sisters. So for over a year, from the time that his parents died, Fred would call his sisters occasionally to see what they wanted to do in terms of the estate, to go over to the house, to divide up the stuff, to make sure that everybody got what they wanted. And for a little over a year, they kept saying, "We're not ready yet. We're just not ready to do it." Until November 16th, 2002. Over a year since his parents had died. And on this date, they all decided that it was finally time to deal with the estate. So Fred and his sisters went to their folks' house, and Fred started going through his father's desk, and his sisters started going through their mother's kitchen. And Fred opened up the center drawer of his father's desk, and there he found 10 envelopes, each with the name of a grandchild on it. These were the envelopes that Sito, that was Fred's mom, that was her name given to her by her grandchildren, would use each Christmas to put money in for her grandchildren that she had planned to give them and to hand to them this time a year ago, Christmas of 2001. Unfortunately, she was not able to do that because she had died. So Fred looked at these envelopes for a while that he held in his hands, and then he decided he'd just throw them away. What good were they after all? Into the wastebasket. And after a while, Fred wandered into the kitchen to see what his sisters were doing, and they were going through the cutlery drawers, packing up their mom's silverware and knives, when they came across this envelope that had $2,400 in it. And all of a sudden, Fred's sisters remembered that just before their mother died, she had been trying to tell them something that was very important to her, but she couldn't remember what it was. She could only remember that it was very important. As soon as Fred heard this, he had this inspiration that he attributes to God to go back to that wastebasket and pull out those 10 envelopes that he had just thrown away and bring them back to his sisters, so they could put the money that they had just found into those envelopes. Now, while he was doing this, his sisters happened upon another cutlery drawer, and underneath it they found an additional $900. In total, they found $3,300, which amounted to $330 per grandchild per envelope. And Fred's sisters asked him what he thought the significance of 33 was. Why would Sito have 33 as a number to be divided out? And Fred proceeded to tell them the story of the time that he and his family had taken their parents down to Atlantic City. Now, Fred's mom was not a big gambler, a gambler really at all, but she liked to go along and watch everybody else have fun, except for this one time when she was with him down at the casino. She wanted to bet some money on the roulette wheel, the worst choice you can make, by the way, if you're a bettor. It's all random. So Fred took her over to the roulette wheel, where she placed her one and only bet on the evening on the number 33. And guess what? That number hit, and she was $3,300 richer. His sisters now tell Fred, this is what Mom was trying to tell us was so important before she died. Then Fred tells his sisters the significance of the number 33. He had asked his mother why she had picked the number in the first place when she placed that bet. And Siddho, who was the spiritual cornerstone of their family, a woman who always insisted that her children thank God every single day when they woke up for their many blessings, she said she'd picked that number because that's how old Jesus was when he died. He was 33. At that moment, Fred said he had this chill that ran up his back and up his arms, and he realized that this is his mother's way of telling all of her children, Fred and his two sisters, that she was with Jesus and that she was fine. This is her way, he said, of communicating with them from beyond. And the reason Fred says that it took them a year and 2 weeks to go to Siddho's house to divide up the stuff was that this was the moment in time that was needed for Fred and his sisters to stop worrying about how to handle the distribution of assets. This was the time when it was finally going to be that we're going to put down all of that anxiety and worry about who gets what. And Fred said, Siddho was in that room with Jesus at that very moment when they found this money. And he felt it. And he had no doubt that it was divinely arranged so that he and his sisters would be inspired to come together over something far more important, which is their love of each other, than over some material stuff, to overcoming being apart and distant over the parents' possessions. And he said, in death, my mother inspired us to do what we could not do for ourselves in this lifetime. And then Fred finished the story by saying to me, Steve, we had to be open and aware of what God was doing for this to happen. It was in an ordinary little thing, such as a cutlery drawer, that God spoke to us. Otherwise, we would have simply split the money between ourselves and missed the greater message that culminated on Christmas Day in 2002 when they passed out their mother's envelopes to their grandchildren. What a Christmas, he said, that was. And as executor of his parents' estate, Fred was entitled to 3% of the entire estate. But Fred's offer to his sisters was that he would let his fee be this, that instead of taking 3% of the assets from their family estate, that he would be the one that got to tell the grandchildren this story as they passed out those envelopes on Christmas Day. Maybe this is what the second coming of Christ is really all about, being able to see how God keeps coming to us, not just a second time, but a third time and a fourth time, forever more coming to us so that we would never be alone and never be without God's presence. If we would just simply slow down and pay attention to the littlest things in life, like cutlery drawers and envelopes, to nature, to the fig tree, to old envelopes, and be aware that God's desire is still to be with us this day, again and again and again, forevermore. Kairos, sacred time. Cutting through our chronos, ordinary time. Amen.